Oh, no.
Brandela.
Hi, Brandon.
Hey.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I hope everyone is well.
Yes.
Does anybody have any questions?
I do.
Good. What is it, Brandy?
What my question is what is Kabbalah say about a deja vu moment? I had an event happen when I was a child, and then like 2 days ago, I had the same event happen.
I'm not sure exactly.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome, Jasmine.
Yeah.
The question that's being asked, for those who didn't hear, is what does Kabbalah say about deja vu events? And Brandy had an event as a child that she has duplicated recently. So the answer is, whatever you were supposed to do the first time in order to achieve the tikkun of that situation, the correction of that situation, whatever you did wasn't correct, and they gave you another chance. That's what a deja vu moment is. But it's never exactly the same event. Now, most people, as I understand, deja vu as it's used in normal conversation in our Western world today, you feel like you've experienced this situation before. Usually you can't identify as this is what happened in my childhood. So you walk into a building in Europe, because you're on a European trip, and you feel like you've been in that building before. That's a deja vu moment, typically. The person can't play it, but that feeling is an indication. It's a moment of mercy from Hashem giving you a sense that whatever happened last time in that building, last lifetime, last childhood, whenever, that you now have to do it differently. I hope that was clarifying for you, Randy.
Yes, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Does anybody have any other questions? It's not unusual for our Wednesday night questions and answers to not have a lot of questions. And there are some weeks that it's, you know, unending questions. So
I have a question.
Go ahead.
You talked about Abraham's son, and that they went to the Rolling Stones, the city where they had Rolling Stones. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I'm not sure what you're referring to as Abraham's son. Abraham had two sons. One
I'm sorry.
Hagar.
I'm sorry for Moses.
You're talking about Moses'
hey,
son?
Yes, Moshe. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. What I said, there's a midrash that says that when Moses was speaking to God. God wants to say, true phones by pressing *6 because I'm getting a lot of static. And whenever you want to interact and ask a question or make a comment, just unmute your phone by pressing *6 again. I appreciate that. So the Midrash is basically describing the event or responding to the event that Moses was talking to God after the sin of the golden calf. And God was saying to Moses, I'm going to destroy the children of Israel and I'm going to create a nation from you. And Moses' response, unlike Noah, and slightly differently or very differently than what Abraham said, because Noah didn't fight for the generation when God said, I'm going to destroy the world. And Abraham, only when God said, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, he argued with him, but it wasn't a complete argument. He stopped at 10 is one explanation, but essentially he accepted God's word instead of continuing to argue. I really shouldn't say argue, to discuss. But Moses said, no, if you do that, if you make me the nation, you take build the nation from me, all of the other nations are going to say that the system is corrupt and that it's, you know, they're going to say things and against you. I don't remember Moses' exact words from the Torah, but essentially Moses was saying, no, I do not accept the nation being built from me. You have to forgive the Jewish people, the children of Israel. You have to forgive them because it's your honor at risk, because the other nations are going to say that you know, you didn't follow through on your words and promises. So, and God relented and forgave the children of Israel. And he also gave Moses the 13 attributes of mercy. But God's words, prophecies that are positive, always come true. So the Midrash comes and says that when the children of Israel were being marched into exile into Babylonia, Moses' children were included in those. The two children of Moses and whatever descendants. And they all disappeared. As they were passing Rachel's tomb on the road to Babylonia, the children of Moses disappeared. The descendants of Moses disappeared. They were there one instant and then they were gone. That's the description, you know, paraphrasing the Midrash. And then in the early 1900s, there is a story that is told through by the Kabbalists and by certain Orthodox communities that there were two travelers that came to Jerusalem. And they said that they were descendants of Moses and the nation that Moses was, the nation that was built from Moses. And that they, when they disappeared, they were put in the, I believe the word is Sambunctan River. And they described the river, and the tradition has always been there, that there is a river somewhere in the world that isn't of water, or it may be of water, but it also has many boulders. And these boulders never stop moving. Except on Shabbat, they all fall silent. They all stop moving. So during the week, it is impossible to cross from one side of the river to the other side. But on Shabbat, you can cross the river because the boulders stop moving. They become quiet and resting on Shabbat. And so these two travelers said, we are from the children, the nation that Moses built, and we live on the other side of this Sambuktan River. I don't remember the exact name. And we're here to tell the children of Israel about us. And they spent a few days in Jerusalem, and then they left. That is the story, the Midrash, that I heard an Orthodox rabbi in Los Angeles tell a group of people, that that's what his experience was, and he heard this from one of the people in Jerusalem who had heard the words directly from these travelers. Does that help you at all, Malcolm?
The river, is that in Jerusalem, or is that, I'm not sure where that river is. I mean,
no.
Can you find it on the map?
At the time that it was that I heard this lecture, the gentleman indicated that it was somewhere between, it was somewhere in the Himalayas. And that at that time, all of the satellite pictures that were available were classified. So you couldn't see anything about that area that where the river was or is. And we don't know where it is, somewhere in the Himalayas. Now, since that time, I believe that every parts of our earth are covered by the Google Maps. But I haven't paid for a membership in Google Maps. There's much of it that is free, but this particular area, I believe, requires a membership cost.
Can you spell the name of the river?
S-A-M-B-U, and there's more letters, but I don't remember them.
Okay. Now, what does it mean, rolling? Would they actually would roll around, or would they rise and fall? Or I'm not, because, you know, there's the Marian, when Marian was in the wilderness, there was a stone that followed them, the well, I guess.
Yes, the well of Marian, where the water flows from.
So was that an actual stone?
There was a...
Or is it a metaphor?
The way it was described, you know, I haven't seen this myself. I'm just describing what I've heard. And mm-hmm. The fold was in the original Hebrew. These stones are multiple stones, huge boulders, that they don't ever stop moving up and down, sideways, back and forth, so that it is impossible to cross this river. You can't take a boat because the stones will break the boat. You can't swim it because the boulders are going to crack your skull. Literally, it is impossible to move across the river because of the boulders moving. Whether that's up or down, sideways, it wasn't explained. But it says, as soon as the bot comes in, the stones and the boulders stop moving.
So once that connection to Marion in the wilderness, it, when the stone followed her, I mean, the well, basically.
It's not. There is no connection to the river Sambunctum. There is no connection to Miriam's well. You're making a connection that Miriam has a well. So there was a stone that followed Miriam, or was there was a stone that moved with the nation that provided the water that they used for cleaning, drinking, and living. And what would happen, according to the Midrash, that when the Jewish people stopped, the stone would flow forth water that would divide into 12 boundaries, which is relating to the boundaries within the Tree of Life glyph that you don't ever see in the glyphs. And that's part of why Rabbi Ashlag teaches us not to not to visualize with using the two-dimensional glyph. But the idea is the water would flow into boundaries to separate between the tribes. And so these rivers, the water flowing from the well of Miriam, which was a rock, would divide into 12 different streams, creating boundaries between the tribes, and then that water would be used as a mikvah. It would be used as drinking water. It would be used as cleaning for the clothing and all of the rest of it.
So when they stopped, there was a stone there that would produce this water, and or was it a particular stone that would follow her?
It was a particular boulder, stone, whatever that would.
Okay.
And it wouldn't follow her. It would follow the children of Israel. But they received it in her merit.
Okay.
And so when she died, the water stopped flowing.
Okay.
Now, I can
and they went to Moses and, they said, the water's no longer here. What are we going to do? And Moses then was told to speak to the rock. And he did not do that. He hit the rock, and the water flowed again, but God was upset with him because he didn't do what he was asked to do, which was to speak to the rock.
Right. I'm just trying to visualize. It could have been a boulder. It could have been a small rock. It could have been something that she may have carried with her. But I'm trying to visualize this boulder, walking alongside the people of Israel.
I can't answer you. We know the dimensions of the Mishkan. We don't know the dimensions of the rock. We don't know if it was a mountain that followed them. We don't know if it was a little stone. There's nothing beyond the abilities of Hashem. So it could have been. Now there's another story from Rabbi Chaim Vital, who is the student of the Ari, that they were crossing the Kinneret River in Israel, the Kinneret Lake in Israel, and the Ari told Rabbi Chaim Vital to dip a cup into the lake and drink at a particular place. And it's in his writings. And people have tried to follow and find that same place. But what he said was this was the water. The well of Miriam is now in the bottom of the Kinneret Lake. And at this particular location, and the water is still flowing. And if you find, go to that spot and find the right spot, there's much blessings in drinking the water from the well of Miriam.
Okay.
I can add a little bit
all
to that.
Midrash. And you have to understand Midrash. The Orthodox community thinks that all Midrash is correct and truthful. The Reform community thinks that Midrash is not, it's just stories that people made up, and some of them are very fanciful. And there are many different thoughts all the way through. So in my own personal opinion, the Midrash is truth. But it's not necessarily truth for our world. So you can have a Midrash that is absolutely opposite and impossible to be relative to another Midrash. They're just in paradox. They can't be both true. And for me, that just means that those Midrashim are describing different worlds, different dimensions where these things happened. And that's how I reconcile it. So for me, the Midrash is true. But every person has this choice for themselves to study the Midrash and evaluate whether there's truth to it or not for them. And there will come a time with Mashiach when we will be able to ask the authors of these stories, was this true? Was this what they experienced? Or was this something they made up? Or is this something that they saw and experienced in a vision and in a psychic phenomena? And we'll know the ultimate truth when the Shia comes. But for me, this is how I reconcile the Midrash. And you need to understand that. So when I tell you stories of the Midrash, it's not necessarily true for you. It's something you need to decide for yourself. So now that I've confused you completely, Malka, do you have any further questions on this particular subject tonight?
What's the Hebrew word for that particular verse that we're just talking about, the stone and Mary? And what's the Hebrew for the stone?
I don't remember whether it's... Hello?
Anna?
Yes, can you hear me?
Now we can hear you, yes.
Okay.
Did you have the third?
Well, whenever I taught the summer workshop on the seven prophetesses, Miriam was one of the prophetesses. And, of course, the research that I found was more or less what you said. It was a rock. Brandy happened to get a book from the library, and from that book we found that Zipporah was the one who taught Miriam to sing a song. And it's those verses about singing the song of spring up a well. I'd have to, you know, go back and look to find it, but it is in the Torah. And the particular book that I found a lot on Miriam did say that the rock was in the Kinneret. But for a while, when Rabbi Zadok was sending out daily messages, he posed a lot of questions. And one of the questions was, do you know where Miriam's well is today? And, of course, you know, I would have said, oh, well, from my studies, it's in the Kinneret, okay? But he also pointed out later, or maybe he didn't, but... another author did, was that there are two letters in the Annabelle Co-op that's the position of Miriam's well. And I'd have to look at, I don't have it in the room. It's on my coffee table. I don't have the Anna McCulloch in the room here. But the two letters, are, they're right in the center of the Anna McCulloch, and the gematria is the same as Miriam's name. And so...
in verse 4, Baruch starts... I know the Anna McCulloch in order, but to start in the middle is difficult.
I know. I usually know the two letters. I think, you know, I was going to see, I thought I had it on my desktop, but I don't see that folder.
Takareim, Rachamei, Tzidkatcha, Gamli. Anyway, the middle two letters, the last letter of one word and the beginning letter of another word,
right,
is a resh and a mem, as I remember. No, it's
no,
290. It's a resh and a tzadi, and
yeah.
The gematria of the resh and tzadi is 290. And 290 is the gematria of Miriam's name.
And there are a lot of other words that pop up too on the Anna McCulloch. After a while, you can find just lots
right.
of names. And, you know, when you look just at the letters, you know, not
there's
so much the words that we sing, but just the letters.
Right. But that's also what people don't really understand about the Anna McCulloch. And I think I've mentioned this more than once. The 42-letter name is the first letters of the words that we sing that we call Anna McCulloch.
Mm-hmm.
But the words are really an after effect. They were written, I believe, in the 1400s. And my explanation, my opinion, is the words were put because we had fallen spiritually, so that the letters by themselves are very powerful and too powerful for our current vessels. And so the words are given there to be a vessel so that the light can be revealed in those words, and we could then handle that light being revealed in that way. Whereas if in earlier generations, they didn't need the words to be the vessels. They were able to handle the light from the 42-letter name directly. That's much as my opinion. I haven't read it anywhere. But, you know, that's what I do, is share these opinions so that you can evaluate it for yourselves. And that's really what I teach, is that each person has their own path to the Creator, meaning their own process and their own visions and their own psychic abilities, their own worlds to go through. And as you do that, you'll find your own truth. The techniques that are taught, this is how you reach these worlds.
So, and up in Moshe's son and descendants, they're hidden, basically.
Because we don't know, because Moshe is a Levite. He's from the tribe of Levi. So all of these children, descendants of Moshe, are from the tribe of Levi. And right now we have the tribe of Judah, which are known as Jews today. And we have the tribe of Benjamin mixed into the tribe of Judah. So that when we say Jew, we could be coming from Benjamin or we could be coming from Judah. And then you have also a certain amount of Levites and a certain amount of Kohanim as descendants of Aaron, and the tribe of Levites is also mixed in, that referred to as Jews today. So you have these three tribes. that are really considered one tribe in the Orthodox tradition. They don't identify the difference other than to say, as an example, my son-in-law is a Cohen. His last name is Kaiser, which is the German rendition of priest. And he is a Cohen. My grandchildren, the males are Cohen, but does it have any meaning in the tradition of Judaism? In the Orthodox tradition, yes. The Kohanim bless the congregations at various times in the services. And before they bless the congregation, the Levites assist them in preparing to bless the congregation. And this is all, you know, Torah law expressed in the Torah. And the rabbis have modified it to relate it to what can we do that still would be effective in drawing energy and relating to the energy, even though the temple doesn't exist in the physical plane. So I've given you information. I'm not sure that it's clear. I hope it is. But we're still... Go ahead.
So these said what? These two descendants that came up and say we're from Moses, we're Moses' descendants in 1900s. Well, a lot happened in the 1900s for Israel.
Correct.
So evidently that was very significant, you know, to reveal themselves. Because
that is
I think they're hidden. And there's going to be a point, I guess, maybe when the Mashiach comes, that they will be revealed. There's some kind of spiritual, cosmic kind of something going on there, you know, because they're hidden and they come out. Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, but I don't know what that full picture is.
Right.
But just to give you an additional insight for something to think about, we know that the Torah prophesizes that Abraham will have descendants and they will be as numerous as the stars in the sky. And I think elsewhere it says the grains of sand on the beaches.
Right.
We haven't reached that number yet in physical human beings. But one of the understandings is right now, according to the estimates, there are approximately 13 or 14 million Jewish people in the world, according to the Orthodox estimates. And 6 million of them are in the United States. And 6 million of them are in Israel. And the balance, 1 or 2 million, is spread around the world. There's a 500,000 in England, and there's 250,000 in France, and so forth. But there's a tribe in India that has been accepted by the Orthodox rabbis as being a descendant of I believe it's the tribe of Dan. No, it's not Dan. It's another one of the tribes.
I think it's Manasseh. Isn't it Manasseh?
It's Manasseh, yes.
Yeah.
But there's 80 million plus of these people that are members of this tribe in India. So here you have the Jews that are 14 million around the world, and you have one tribe that's 30 million. So when Mashiach comes and we get a full picture, we're going to find that all of the children of Israel spread around the world are going to number the stars in the sky and the grains of sand on the beaches.
That's true.
But unfortunately, of the 30 million, there's only like 6,000 that have made Aliyah to Israel.
Right.
But more and more are coming every year, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
I think we may not have time to discuss this, but I read an interesting article a couple of days ago about the Native American Indian.
Some rabbis who think that the Indians, the Native American
right.
Indians, are descendants of a certain tribe.
I think they say Ephraim. Ephraim, I think they said. I think that's what I read.
The tribe of Ephraim.
But they
don't know, and it's not yet accepted generally. But there are places in the United States that have writing on rocks that are Hebrew letters.
I think that's in Mexico.
In New Mexico. And the Hopi Indians from New Mexico have a story, have a tradition that they came up out of the earth, representing the inner earth, which we have many midrashim about. So it's all interrelated.
Right. It was just a very interesting article. And in their rituals, they're real connected to nature. And their songs, I guess you would say, that they use Yahweh a lot in their singing while they're meditating to the wind and the rains and real connected to nature. So it was a good article.
I mean, I have read that article, but I've read earlier articles over the last 20 years. And there is a relationship between the holidays and I have been accused, I don't mean it in a negative way, it's been suggested that when I'm doing the reading in the Hebrew letters, that sometimes it just comes across to someone who's not familiar with Hebrew chanting, that it sounds like the Indians, what they're doing on the television screens, which is a copy of what the Indians really told them to do when Hollywood started back in the early 1900s.
Right. They even talk about oral traditions, from their fathers and their ancestors and so forth and so on. They talk about the oral law, oral tradition, stories,
yes.
I guess. And they also said that they think they come from Spain, basically, and they were migrated down or shipped from Spain.
Well,
I think I also read that.
There is a connection because the expulsion from Spain in 1492 took place on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av. And that was the day that Columbus and his three ships left for the New World. So there's very much a connection there. And it is known that there were a lot of, I'm not going to call them Muranos, but there's a lot of crypto-Jews, Spanish people, who pretended to convert to Catholicism in order to stay in Spain and Portugal. But in order to get away from the Inquisition, they became explorers and investors, and they moved to the New World. whatever the New World meant as we know. And there are a lot of, Rabbi Berg once said, of the 350 million people in South America, more than 80 million of them, more than a quarter of them were or are children of Israel.
Wow. You know, here in Louisiana, parts of Louisiana, we have a big, lots of history of Native Americans, you know, and the and the territories that they possessed. And that's pretty interesting as well to go there and study, you know, the history of the Native Americans. And it's right here in our backyard, you know, where I live, basically.
Right. There's a lot of the world that we don't really understand, a lot of history we don't understand. And you always have to remember, history is written by the victor. And if it doesn't fit his narrative, it doesn't get written down.
Right.
Any other questions? I bid shalom to all of you. I hope you have a good week. Tomorrow's classes at 4:30 is Advanced Reincarnation. And at 7 o'clock will be a Zohar class on the Parasha of Pikudei. And Pikudei is really, we speak of the Torah being the blueprint of creation. Well, the Mishkan and the Parasha of Pikudei is the blueprint of the Torah. Because the Mishkan is really the universe in a microcosmic sense. But we won't be really talking about that specifically tomorrow. But if you read the whole section of Pikudei from the Zohar, which is a very extensive section, you have all aspects of creation revealed in the Zohar on Pikudei. So I bid you all shalom, and I hope you'll join us for one or both of the classes tomorrow.
Thank you.
Shalom. Good night, all.
Good night.